Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Jean Monnet Centers on Citizens' Rights. I'm Romane Lieber, and this is a series of conversations with guest speakers or project team members. Today, we are going to talk about free movement rights in a pandemic. That was the title of an academic seminar which took place last January here at UCC. It was the first event of Work Package 2 that explores the connection between citizens of the Union through rights and considers how these fail or succeed in generating legitimacy. The seminar focused on restrictions on free movement rights during the COVID-19 pandemic and their consequences on EU citizenship. More largely, this seminar asks the question of to what extent EU-derived rights, and in particular EU citizenship rights, can be exercised by citizens in times of crisis. The seminar hosted three legal scholars as speakers, Professor Daniel Thiem from Constance University, Dr. Nathan Cambion from Antwerp University, and Professor Dora Kostakopoulou from KU Leuven University. To talk about this, we have here today Dr. Stephen Coote, who organized a very interesting seminar. So you're very welcome today, Stephen. So Dr. Stephen Coote is a lecturer in EU law here at UCC. His research focuses on the constitutional dimension of European law, EU citizenship, and fundamental rights. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And let me ask you this first question. So while we are still officially in a pandemic, the drastic measures taken by member states and the EU have been lifted some time ago. So by drastic measures, I'm referring to closing the border, to the reintroduction of border control in the Schengen area, or even to the EU external travel ban. Mm. So why choose to do a seminar on that subject now? Why is that relevant to wonder about free movement rights during the pandemic after the crisis has passed?
During the pandemic, and I suppose that it was it's on foot of a number of different crises. There's always this talk about crisis and how the European Union has responded to crisis. And I think a lot of people's impression was that the European Union had a good pandemic in the sense that it showed the added value of the European Union in relation to vaccine procurement, for example, and other health policies. But one area which I think was a little bit underanalyzed was the crisis in relation to free movement, and in particular free movement of persons. And then that brings me on, I suppose, to talk a little bit about why this is interesting now, sort of after the event. And that's just simply that it was a stress test for free movement, if you like. And it's interesting to analyze it, I think, from the level or the perspective of the individual legal measures, the specific measures which you already mentioned in the introduction, and how they were handled by European Union law, what the framework of European Union law is for dealing with emergencies of this kind, perhaps where the European Union itself lacks a concrete competence, and how well those legal frameworks, I suppose, worked in the context of absolute crisis. Then I think there's sort of a broader question as well, which is interesting and which flows from that first initial question, which is the renationalization of the European space is what I would call it. There was this sort of folding back into national frameworks of analysis, borders went up, and member states themselves sort of eclipsed the European Union as actors willing to or wishing to protect and provide security, in this case health security, for their citizens. So I think at least at the initial stages of the pandemic, there was this almost displacement of the European Union as an actor and of key concepts and principles of European Union law, in particular free movement law, the European citizenship law, and a reassertion of member state sovereignty over their territorial space. So I think it's interesting, as I said, in general, from the perspective as a sort of a stress test, a crisis, and how well the legal framework operated. And then I think it was interesting just to see how quickly the member states reasserted themselves. And one of the key achievements of European integration, so free movement, was somehow displaced or effaced in the face of this crisis.
Well, that come back a little bit to the second point I wanted to talk about, because some of these measures could have been seen as in accordance with EU law. For instance, Professor Thiem and Dr. Cambion mentioned that we could find some legality under the grant of public policy threat in the Schengen Border Code, or Public Health on Directive 2004/38. But they questioned the proportionality and the coherence of the measures. Mm. So do you think it was more a matter of a lack of proportionality or coherence?
I think that's probably correct, actually, to be honest with you. First of all, I think it's very good that you just distinguish between the two measures there, that you, which also point to the two different areas which are at stake here. So just, I mean, the purpose, you know, legal clarity. There's obviously two general areas of law here at stake. One is free movement law, which is governed principally by Directive 2004/38, and then the other is the Schengen area, the Schengen Border Code. Now, under both the Directive and Free Movement Law and the Schengen Border Code, there is the possibility of restrictions in terms of public health and public security, public policy. And public health actually doesn't arise as a ground in the Schengen Border Code, but most people, I think, would have accepted that given the nature of the pandemic, sort of generalised nature, that it would generally speaking fall under public order. You know, so it was. And then just to, I suppose, to clarify in terms of how these measures were, or what the legal framework is, a lot of measures which were adopted by member states were prima facie, I suppose, a restriction on free movement rights, or an exception to the open borders that you find in the Schengen Border Code. So the Schengen Border Code is very clearly, I mean, if there's a reinstation of borders, you know, that's an exception to the general rule under the Schengen system, which should be that there should be no border controls. So obviously the border controls in and of themselves fell to be analysed under the Schengen Border Code. For the free movement, there was a series of measures then which were adopted by member states. Entry bans initially, you know, the very early stages, except for citizens and for normally for residents as well. But then in the later stages of the pandemic, there were also measures which could be characterised as restrictions on free movement. So vaccine passports, quarantine measures, even the passenger locator form, I think, could be maybe constitute a restriction. So there were restrictions on free movement. There was the reintroduction of border controls, which are prima facie, you know, sort of problematic from the point of European Union law. You're right that both the Schengen Border Code and the Directive 2004/38, do have the possibility of justifying these exceptions, if you like. So under the Schengen Border Code, you have a series of articles 25 and 28. And similarly under the directive for general reasons of public health. So member states do have this possibility of exercising their powers, if you like, and setting aside European Union law. But that, of course, is then subject to the control of European Union law. And you rightly flagged the question of proportionality. And I think that's probably where the strongest critique emerges. And I mean, you could fit a lot of things under proportionality, but I suppose to be a bit more systematic, the question of justification arises, and that justification should, in theory, be backed up with appropriate evidence. It needs to be appropriate to achieve the goal. And there was questions around the appropriateness, for example, of border controls, whether that actually was a measure which contributed to combating the pandemic. Similarly for other measures. So there was a lack of scientific evidence, I suppose, was one thing that some people pointed to. Other people would have said that the precautionary principle would have allowed you to act even in the absence of clear scientific evidence. But the proportionality, there are questions that could be raised around the proportionality of some of the measures, the extreme nature of some of the entry bans, at least in the initial phases, and also, you know, some of the quarantine measures. So for example, Ireland, if I remember correctly, towards the end of the pandemic, introduced, you know, a 2-week quarantine in a hotel for which you had to pay for yourself. I mean, it seemed like a very burdensome restriction on free movement. And something similar, I think, was introduced in Norway. So some of these measures, I suppose you have to ask, did they go beyond what was necessary? Were they properly thought through? Did member states do a good enough job, I suppose, to justify them on objective and scientific grounds is the question, you know, rather than kind of reaching for knee-jerk measures. So, yes, you're right. Generally speaking, and this is a broader point as well, that during the pandemic, there was heavy criticism of some of the member state action from the EU law academic community. I would have a little bit more sympathy, I think, as you would find, you know, as your question seemed to imply, for the member states in this particular area, that the European Union itself doesn't have a generalised health competence, that competence falls to the member states. They do need to take measures in such an emergency situation, but maybe in the context of the pandemic, when everything was so heightened and so tense, and member states needed to react to concerns of their own population as well. That's, I mean, that political context, I think, needs to be taken into account. The member states needed to be seen to be doing something. They took actions. Were the measures appropriately backed up by science? Were they justified in a proper, objective manner in all cases? Were they proportionate? I think there are questions to be asked, I suppose, around some of the more extreme measures.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah.
And I want to move on to another point. It's about the principle of non-discrimination, because that was another issue. It's really a core component of EU law. But we've seen a lot of differentiation of treatment, though, during the pandemic. For instance, Dr. Kamian mentioned differentiation of treatment between different type of vaccination, between national of member state and third country national living in that same member state. So do you think that the principle of non-discrimination has been overlooked during the pandemic?
I can see the point. So there, I think there are two instances, I suppose, where discrimination arose. One was the application of entry bans into member states and whether they discriminated there on the basis of nationality. I think in general, I mean, I haven't done a systematic look through all the member states, that the entry bans normally had exceptions for citizens and for resident, at least resident union citizens, and most often resident, just long-term residents generally, so non-nationals, including third country nationals. I suppose there is a degree of discrimination, and I should mention actually Hungary initially did simply restrict its entry ban to Hungarian, or sorry, limit the exception to its entry ban, if you understand, so it would only allow Hungarians in. That was how it was announced, but actually in practice it operated as well to include resident union citizens. So I mean, there's an argument on that you could say that non-resident nationals were allowed entry into their member states, whereas non-resident EU citizens who are non-nationals, so take the example of Hungary, you know, an EU citizen who isn't a resident of Hungary was able to enter. So there was a difference of treatment in that sense. I mean, I think that would probably be seen as justified, simply because, as a rule of international law, member states can't deny entry into their own territory of their own citizens. And you see phrases like this appearing in some of the Court of Justice's jurisprudence, actually, around public order exception, public security exception. So I think there is that slight difference in treatment in the sense that non-national citizens who were also non-resident were excluded, whereas national citizens were included. I think that's, as I said, justifiable. Obviously, it would not have been justifiable if resident union citizens had been excluded. The second area which the issue of non-discrimination arose was actually in the application of the vaccine passport. There was some people criticised, I suppose, or heavily critiqued, at least the initial draft of the regulation, which applied. I'm not sure if we need to go into that in this detail. I hope people know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the vaccine passport. So this was governed by EU regulation, which was adopted, which obliged member states to accept a vaccine passport issued by other member states. There was some talk that this was discriminatory because those vaccine passports had to, or would only be issued for individuals who had received a vaccine which was approved by the EMA, you know, the European Medical Agency, I think it's called. And of course, there were some member states which had been using vaccines which were non-EMA approved, in particular the Russian vaccine, Sputnik or something, I think it was
Yes.
called. Yeah. So in theory, the way that draft of the regulation operates would have discriminated against certain member states, because certain citizens of the Union, so Hungarians, are much more likely to have been vaccinated using the Sputnik vaccine, and therefore they wouldn't have been able to use the vaccine passport to travel. That was attenuated a little bit by the final version of the regulation, which also allowed member states, so they were obliged to accept individuals who had a vaccine issue, you know, which was certified by the EMA, and they could have accepted passports held by people who had received vaccines. I think they were WHO approved or something like this. So there was an option there, So not entirely, you know, it still doesn't entirely eliminate the discrimination, if we want to call it that. So people did say that this was discriminatory. There was arguments as well, I suppose, that it could have discriminated against individuals who did not wish to get vaccinated for various reasons. But the vaccine passport, the regulation eventually does allow people to travel. There were other forms, I call it the vaccine passport for short, but people could have obtained a similar document which would allow them similar free movement rights with a test, right? With an approved test, or if they showed that they were recently recovered. So, you know, my own sense, maybe I disagree, it's a little bit similar to the previous question, is that I don't really see this as very problematic. I do understand the argument that certain nationalities are going to be more impacted by this measure, which restricts its application to vaccines which are issued by or approved by the EMA. But it's a mutual trust system, right? Sorry, it's a mutual recognition system. I mean, ultimately what this is, it's a mutual recognition system where member states agree to recognize vaccine passports which have been issued by other member states, right? So that's the structure of it, legally speaking. It's mutual recognition, and mutual recognition always depends on mutual trust, right? That's why you have a regulatory framework which frames the operation of mutual recognition, and that trust has to be based on something, right? And that's what it does. I mean, so these rules around which vaccines could be accepted and which should not be accepted, you know, actually makes the whole system operate. And so, again, there were accusations of discrimination in that context, but I personally think that you have to accept it's a paradox of regulation, right? That in order to facilitate freedom, you have to restrict that freedom in certain ways, you know. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you mentioned that more a little bit earlier, actually, when you discussed the measures, and that you were putting in doubt the legality of those measures as well. So do you think actually the Commission during the pandemic, they didn't take any infringement procedure, was not taking under Article 258. So do you think the Commission has overlooked its role of guardian of the treaty during the pandemic?
I think so. I think it points to a broader... So. Yes, I think that I didn't go into a huge amount of detail, but I think there are certainly questions around, as I said, some of the more extreme measures which were adopted. And also something which I didn't mention before was the fact that border controls were always, or even travel restrictions were always framed in a national way, right? Which actually, you know, doesn't make sense from an objective point of view. I mean, Daniel himself uses this simple example that, you know, he lives near the border, he can't travel to Switzerland or someone similar, you know, from France to, or from Germany to Luxembourg, couldn't move, go from Frankfurt to Luxembourg, whereas they can travel from Frankfurt to Berlin, you know, where, you know, so it doesn't make sense from an objective scientific point of view. So there definitely were areas that either the Commission could have acted, I think, legally speaking. It didn't. Now, I think there were probably some informal discussions, presumably, and I know that the surveillance authority, the EFTA surveillance authority, did at least send a letter to Norway, for example. So there may have been, I suppose, more informal discussions and interactions with the member states around their measures. But yeah, it didn't open formal proceedings. It never really threatened that. All the measures which it adopted were sort of soft law coordinating measures. It issued loads of these guidelines throughout the pandemic to try and get member states to coordinate. I think that probably is due to the sort of politics and the constitutional situation. And what I mean by that, I mean the politics are very obvious, right? I mean, it was in the middle of a pandemic. As I said earlier, you know, very tense, charged situation. Member states had to demonstrate that they... I mean, the basic function of a state is to promote the security and the health of its population. And the member states were taking that role on. Would it have been... Maybe the Commission felt that it could facilitate opening up free movement more easily by cooperation with the member states rather than taking a more confrontational approach. But there is that sort of political element, but it does point to the broader issue which I flagged at the top, which is that you did see this, the receding of the presence, if you like, of the EU institutions and their legal powers, you know, in the face of this crisis, and you know, ultimately, you know, EU law, both in a substantive sense in terms of the free movement rights, which were, you know, curtailed very drastically, but also the kind of institutional presence of European Union law, you know, in the shape of the Commission and its enforcement capacity, you know, also just sort of disappeared, you know. So yeah, I do think it's, and this is why, I mean, it's an interesting case study, you know, why your first question, you know, about why study this question, why think about it, talk about this question, is because it's precisely that. It's that in the face of this overwhelming crisis, this emergency, this reassertion of member state power, that the political will simply wasn't there on the part, and you get this disappearing into the background of European Union law, very much so.
So you mentioned that the Commission was like maybe more active with soft law instruments. And that makes me come back to a point of Professor Costacopoulou, because she mentioned that the Commission has published three different documents during the pandemic. So one was focusing on the strengthening of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, another one on the Democracy Action Plan, and the last one related to EU citizenship. She argued that through this document, the Commission has acknowledged that we needed to close the gap in the protection of human rights, to take action to safeguard democracy and enhance EU citizenship. So do you think that the pandemic has highlighted issues in these three areas? So human rights, protection of human rights, democracy and citizenship?
Yes. Obviously, citizenship, very clearly, if we understand citizenship in the kind of free movement mode, although I think Professor Costacopoulou meant citizenship in a broader sense as well, in terms of, you know, membership of the European Union as a political community and what that entails in a broader sense. Democracy, the Charter of Fundamental Rights, yes. I mean, I think there are broader questions. I think that those three areas are best thought in the wider context of crisis, if we can use that term, or turmoil or change, and that the European Union is going through. I mean, specifically to the, and I think what her, I might be anticipating what you want to say, but I think what her the general thrust of her thinking is that the European Union, in order to deal with these challenges, needs to strengthen its legitimacy, broadly speaking, and its connection with its citizens, if you like. But going to the kind of specific three areas of democracy, fundamental rights, and then citizenship, I think yes, and it kind of goes back to maybe this theme that's arising out of this conversation. You know, it goes back to this idea that when it came to it, you know, when a crisis actually occurred, it was the member states which displaced the European Union, which reasserted their presence in lots of ways, obviously in a very clear sort of legal sense, in the way that we've already described, in terms of adopting measures and creating this kind of national territory, and fracturing the European territory to some extent, but also, you know, as political communities in a way, you know, so fundamental rights, interestingly, I think, and it's something which has been completely overlooked actually in the discussion of the pandemic. I mean, even I was there talking about the different measures and the measures that you can, you know, the justification of and whatnot. I mean, these all have to be fundamental rights compliant as well, of course. And there was no analysis of that, right? There was no analysis of family life, for example, you know, which is obviously very relevant. Best interests of children, you know, for example, would be a very relevant right in these contexts as well. So I think it was an oversight, certainly, fundamental rights. Democracy, again, you know, I think this goes back to the need to legitimate the actions of the European institutions, and then finally, and citizenship as well. So I think something can be said, I suppose, in those three areas in relation to the pandemic. But I think the broader point is that the European Union, you know, as a polity, as an entity, needs to be buttressed, and its legitimacy needs to be reinforced. And you do this through acting along those, you know, those three axes, those fundamental rights, democracy, citizenship.
Well, that makes me come back to the Jean Monnet research focus, because it's actually to investigate how EU data rights can contribute to the EU legitimacy in the EU, in its neighbourhood and globally, while adopting a citizen perspective and considering how citizens perceive their right or use their right. In the context of a crisis, are EU citizenship and free movement rights usable for citizens? You already kind of answered the question a little bit, but do you think that the use can contribute to the EU legitimacy?
The use of the free movement rights, and yes, I mean it's a very broader question. It's a much general question: the relationship between rights and legitimacy. I suppose the legitimacy of the European Union in terms of its social acceptability, its normative legitimacy as well. What I would say is that free movement rights, and in particular the use, it's something that came out a little bit in the pandemic as well. If you look at some of the policy documents of the Commission in particular, when it was trying to reopen the European Union, and as well you see this actually with the regulation in terms of the vaccine passport, I mean, they use this phrase of the European way of life, right? And I think that's it's problematic in many ways, but I think it is indicative of the broader significance of free movement rights, okay? And what I mean by this is the point of free movement rights and union citizenship rights, yes, fine, it's the ability to go and study and do these individual activities, if you like, in other member states. But there's a much broader significance, which is that Europe, what free movement allows is that it, in a sense, offers the European Union, all the member states, and the life that goes with that to the individual citizen. Maybe I'm not explaining myself properly, but European Union free movement rights allows you to travel around Europe, it allows you to partake of all the different opportunities, and that's what I think what they mean by the European way of life, right? It's a way of life which is transnational, it's a way of life, or at least has the option of transnational, and I think that's not to be minimized either, you know, it's a significant thing, and that's what was called into question by the pandemic, right? By the restriction on free movement rights that are restricting us to our individual states. And in Ireland, we're on an island, and it felt very much like an island in the context of the pandemic, very much so. Whereas union citizenship and the free movement rights which are attached to it, you know, offer a much broader perspective, a much broader horizon for people. And that's what was curtailed in the context of the pandemic, and that's what the Commission and the European institutions tried to re-achieve and to recreate, initially through coordinating measures and then through the vaccine passport itself. So I think maybe that points to one element. I'm not sure how that relates to legitimacy. I think it probably does, in the sense that union citizens are offered something by European Union, which is the European Union as a whole, this way of life. I don't know how you want to talk about legitimacy, like input legitimacy, output legitimacy. Like in some sense, it's like output legitimacy because it's something which is being offered to the citizen, right? It's a public good which is being offered to the citizen. But that's, I think, tends to trivialize it. You know, it's not like bread and circus. It's not like something, it's not something very trivial, but I think it's something significant, and I think it allows the European citizen to enjoy Europe, right? The European way of life. And I think that's significant. And I think that's what ultimately will legitimize and justify the EU, right? So I don't know if that makes the connection between rights and legitimacy. But I think if you understand the importance of free movement rights in their broader context and what they offer more broadly, which is, you know, membership in this plural political space that is European Union, then you can see quite clearly how it can contribute towards legitimacy.
Well, thank you very much for this very interesting conversation on EU legitimacy and on free movement rights, during the crisis. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch for our next podcast that will be broadcasted next month. In the meantime, don't forget that our next event is around the corner. And if you too are interested by social rights, if you also wonder about instrument of direct democracy at the European level, come to our seminar on the European Citizen Initiative that will focus on the FEL initiative of the Universal Basic Income. Check our website UCC Law European Integration. We look forward to see you at the next event.